afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. It's a great pleasure to introduce today's speaker for this Sales Lunchtime Seminar. As Professor Armstrong mentioned this morning in his email, our very own Nita, and you'll forgive me in a moment, has burst with pride. Niamh came to Cambridge in 2003. She was an undergraduate at Girton, and I can say from first-hand experience, she's one of the best students we've ever had, and we are extremely proud of her. She then went on to New York to do an LLM. Then she spent some time working with the Irish Competition Authority. While she was doing that, she also achieved an MA at King's College London in competition law. And then she returned to Cambridge to do a PhD on the interaction between competition and regulation. A PhD which she completed exactly within 3 years, and then she was awarded the degree with no corrections. And she has recently received an offer for publication of her PhD as a monograph with Cambridge University Press. She's also, as many of you know, a lecturer in law and a fellow at Fitzwilliam. As you can see, very impressive indeed. So I know we are all looking forward to hearing her presentation today. She's going to talk about the role of private enforcement within EU competition law, and she will kindly take some questions afterwards. So over to you.
Thank you for that very kind introduction, Albertina. I'm going to talk on the general topic of private enforcement. I think a slightly different topic title went around previously, so I hope nobody's disappointed about this. Private enforcement is one of those subjects which, in one sense, is kind of done to death in that there's so much written about it and constantly new articles emerge. The reason for this is that it is constantly changing, and it's an area where there's a huge amount of new case law constantly, and also the European Commission has since the Courage and Graham decision in 2001, been constantly working to facilitate and encourage the development of a culture of competition at member state level in the European Union. So what I'm going to look at specifically is the role of private enforcement. So this means what private enforcement seeks to achieve within the larger framework of competition law. I'm going to look at the evolution and development of the concepts in the EU. And then I'm going to ask whether the rhetoric of what the court says and the commission says about private enforcement, that it's this universal concept always available whenever there's any breach of Articles 101 or 102, actually is realistic when you look at the developing framework for private enforcement at, I suppose, both the EU level and at the member state level. So that is, I suppose, an overview of the presentation. When we talk about private enforcement, we're referring to what the Commission calls the antitrust rules. So this is just 101 and 102. 101 prohibits all agreements between undertakings, decisions by associations of undertakings, and concerted practices which may affect trade and have the object of or effect of preventing, restricting, or distorting competition. Within EU law, this covers a very wide spectrum of things, from secret hardcore cartels at fixed prices share markets to distribution agreements or even non-secret horizontal agreements. Like, for example, one of the very prominent 101 cases in the EU at the moment is the question of whether price setting by Microsoft or Visa setting the interchange fees breaches 101. That's a case before the Court of Justice at the moment. Even if it does breach 101.1, it can potentially be saved by the efficiency criteria in 101.3. 102 TFEU covers the abuse of dominance by one or more undertakings. This means unilateral conduct by an undertaking that has market power, which may lead to anti-competitive effects. And we can contrast this to merger control and state aid, which are included within the broader corpus of competition law at the EU level, but are only enforced by the Commission. So we don't have any scope for private enforcement as such there. Before we look at the actual, I suppose, rules on private enforcement at an EU level, it's worthwhile thinking about what the competition rules seek to prohibit or seek to encourage. The first conception that you might have of the prohibition in Article 101 or 102 is that of a public wrong, something that is a wrong as against society as a whole. And the economic rationale here would be, when you look at the effects of monopoly, you get this suboptimal distribution of resources that affects society as a whole. We have a deadweight loss that leads to an overall reduction in the wealth of society. And we also have rent-seeking behavior. So people who seek to achieve monopoly, they waste resources in trying to get that monopoly position. So basically, society as a whole is disadvantaged by anti-competitive behavior, which is why you would prohibit it. The moral rationale here, if competition lawyers don't talk about morals very much, but if we look at the moral rationale, it's the equivalent to theft and property offences. So the quote on the slide, when we break up cartels, it is to stop money being stolen from customers' pockets, comes from Commissioner Neelie Kroes, who was the competition commissioner, and she's explaining why you would go after hardcore cartels, because it's equivalent to theft. If this analogy becomes a little bit strange when you look at 102 offences, you kind of have to say, by denying people best value for money, or by restricting their choice, or by restricting innovation, you are indirectly, obliquely stealing from them. The mention of Christine Parker on the slide, she's a legal sociologist at Monash University, and she's very emphatic that there is no moral dimension to competition law. It is entirely just an economic, only an economic rationale. It's the state saying we're going to compel economic efficiency. If we see competition violations as a public wrong, this demands a public response. And at the EU level, we have administrative proceedings by the Commission for public enforcement of 101 and 102, leading to, under Article 7 of Regulation 1 of 2003, infringement decisions, so findings of breach, and usually the imposition of a fine, which can be a very, very high fine. So last month, we had the Libor decision that imposed fines of 1.7 billion on banks, which had set the interchange fees, which also included an immunity discount of 2.5 billion for UBS, because it basically dobbed in the others, but could potentially, if they hadn't done so, they would have had fines of 2.5 billion levied on them. We don't have criminal enforcement at the EU level, but we do at the member state level, including on Monday, the OFT announced it is taking criminal proceedings against a particular individual. So there have been mixed experiences with criminal enforcement at a member state level in the EU, but it is possible. And there's also an obligation on member states to apply, usually through administrative proceedings, the European competition rules where there's an effect on interstate trade. We may also see the competition provisions as encapsulating a private wrong. The economic rationale here is that monopoly leads to sort of wealth transfers from consumers to producers. That means there are specific consumers who lose money. They have had to give it illegitimately to specific producers. And it's this obligations-based idea that they should be able to bring legal action to retrieve the money that they paid for an illegal reason, or obtained from them illegally. If we want to say there's a moral rationale here, we might have to argue that these are the particular pockets from which the money has been stolen, and so a sort of disgorgement or restitution-based idea would suggest that you can get the money back. We will talk about private enforcement at the EU level in detail in a few minutes' time, but it's quite useful to think about the US experience in this context. So more than 90% of competition law actions in the US are brought by private attorneys general. They are private litigation cases. It's in one sense hugely successful in this regard. Private enforcement is well established as the primary mode of enforcement of the US antitrust rules. And there are a lot of very plaintiff-friendly rules and procedures available for this. So jury trials, pretrial discovery, triple damages, one-way fee shifting. The converse of this is that it's very controversial. It leads to what is seen as a lot of wasteful and unmeritorious litigation. And the EU institutions have been very emphatic about the fact that they don't want US-style litigation in the EU. A third conception of the nature and purpose of competition law is a market failure idea. And this is one that we don't see so much in terms of, in the language of enforcement or the language of the courts, but it's one that actually has quite an important practical implication. The quote on the slide is the very famous economic definition of, or classic economic definition of what is market failure. Most competition authorities, including the European Commission, use the more, I suppose, colloquial expression, markets that are not working well. Here, the focus again is on the suboptimal distribution, the disadvantage to society as a whole, but the focus here is less on fault for this suboptimal distribution and more on ameliorating or remedying the harm that results. So it's about, I suppose, curing harm rather than punishing fault. The question of whether antitrust is a regulatory enterprise is a very long-standing one in US law. There's a lot of hand-wringing as to whether this has happened and whether if it has happened, it's problematic. It's maybe less of a concern on one level in the EU because the EU has EU competition rules have historically been enforced through quite a regulatory framework anyway, very centralized enforcement in the European Commission, an obligation to notify agreements, rules that were quite formalistic in a sense, which led to quite regulatory type outcomes. This has changed in the past decade or so as EU competition has been modernized, it's been decentralized, and we have a more economic approach to competition enforcement and the substantive content of the rules. The flip side is under Regulation 1 of 2003, we have the commitment decision procedure. And this has reintroduced quite a strong regulatory flavor into enforcement in the EU. So now about half of all EU enforcement cases taken by the European Commission are concluded via the commitment decision procedure. This involves ex ante type enforcement with prospective remedies. It doesn't involve any binding findings of breach, but it is about fixing the market problem going forward. And you do see noticeably more regulatory type theories of harm and remedies being imposed under the Article 9 procedure. What is the purpose of EU competition law? So public and private enforcement have been identified as the two pillars of enforcement of the EU antitrust rules. The second and third bullet points, this language is taken specifically from a 2013 document from the Commission on quantifying harm. Talking about fines and public enforcement under Article 9, the purpose is deterrence, specific deterrence, deterring the anti-competitive undertaking, the undertaking that has breached the competition rules, and general deterrence, trying to persuade others not to do the same thing in the future. Whereas private enforcement is seen as being aimed primarily at compensation for the losses that have been suffered, whereas there's also these, I suppose, greater benefits of deterrence and competition law compliance, which arise obliquely as a result of the risk of private enforcement and the risk that you may have to pay out money if you breach the rules. The Article 9 decision procedure, the commitment decision procedure, has a slightly different focus. So this language is taken from the Commission's 2009 report on the functioning of Article 1 of 2003. It said that the purpose of the commitment decision procedure is to preserve effective competition and obtain faster changes in the market for the future. So less a focus on the actual breach of the rules involved, more on ameliorating the problem that has arisen as a result. And this, I suppose, give and take approach is reflected in the Court of Justice's rather controversial decision in Al Rosa, where it specifically accepts that there may be, that undertakings may go beyond what would be required of them under competition law to avoid the finding of breach that results. So a very different sort of relationship between the enforcement agency and the undertaking in Article 9 and Article 7 decisions. I'm going to turn now to the question of private enforcement more generally. This originated in the case law of the Court of Justice and has been developed by the European Commission through a series of, administrative consultation procedures to try and arrive at a point where we can actually legislate to improve private enforcement. So the starting point is the direct effect of Articles 101 and 102 TFEU, which has been established since the 1970s. This means that individuals get rights directly within the national system as a result of the competition rules, with a sort of concomitant duty on national courts to safeguard the rights that are granted. It isn't until 2001 with the Courage case, however, that the court articulates a distinct right to damages as a result of breach of Article 101 or 102. Well, specifically in the Courage case, it was 101. The court was asked about the impact of breach of Article 101 in what was actually a vertical agreement situation, so not a hardcore cartel situation, but it is an Article 101 case. And it answered that the full effectiveness of Article 101 TFEU, and in particular the practical effect of the prohibition laid down there, would be put at risk if it were not open to any individual to claim damages for loss caused to him by a contract or by any or by conduct liable to restrict or distort competition. So specifically in relation to Article 101, but broader language that would encompass 102. And the reasoning for this is that the existence of such a right strengthens the workings of the community competition rules and discourages agreements or practices which are frequently covert, which are liable to restrict or distort competition. From that point of view, actions for damages before the national courts can make a significant contribution to the maintenance of effective competition in the community. There's quite an interesting and as yet still unresolved question as to whether this is just one iteration of the general rules of national procedural autonomy coupled with the requirements of effectiveness and equivalence. And the court does say that these are, I suppose, the procedural requirements for actually applying or realising the right to damages under Courage and Crehan, or whether the case is actually a little bit closer to Frankovic, so it is a distinct right derived from EU law, which is, I suppose, maybe to an extent, on a slightly higher plane than just the general rules relating to direct effect and national procedural autonomy. This isn't that, I suppose I don't actually have an opinion on this point, I have to say. I haven't really thought much about it. I should have said it right at the start. This is a work in progress, so I am at the end going to be asking you questions on what you think is happening with this. I think that this issue is potentially important when we come right to the end, and I would be quite interested to know whether people have any opinions on what they think are the implications. In terms of practical application at the member state level, there isn't much that's going to separate the two interpretations. We then, in 2006, had the Manfredi case. Manfredi is quite interesting because Manfredi was what was a horizontal cartel case, essentially, but the court goes much broader in its wording, and it actually talks numerous times about both Article 101 and 102 TFEU. It says these principles are a matter of public policy. It reiterates the Courage right to damages. And then it talks a little bit more about the, I suppose, criteria for applying or realizing the Courage right. In particular, it says that the principle of full compensation for breach of EU law rights, which comes from the Marshall No. 2 case, applies in private actions or private enforcement actions in the competition law realm, which includes both actual losses and loss of profits. And it notes that there is a causal link required between breach and harm. A series of more recent cases have raised some more complex issues relating to, I suppose, the scope of the right to damages. One of the big issues has been that raised by the Fliederer decision and confirmed by the Don O'Shemi decision, which is the interaction between public leniency programs and private damages actions. And the issue here is that leniency programs they arise in the context of cartels. So cartels are horizontal, usually secret, price-sharing, market-fixing arrangements. At the Commission level and at most member state levels, there are leniency programs whereby if you basically give the competition authority sufficient evidence of the cartel so that they can bring an investigation and prosecute it, you are prosecuted and you are found guilty or you're found liable, but you get full immunity from fines. And this is why UBS avoids the €2.5 billion fine last month. The difficulty here is that in order to make a public leniency application, you're going to have to provide the competition authority with very incriminating evidence. And the question in Fliederer is whether the right to access to documents under EU law would protect or require disclosure of that information. And in Fleiderer, the Court of Justice was asked to declare a principle that leniency material is completely unavailable in disclosure in these cases. They refused to do so. They said it depends on a case-by-case assessment done at the national level. They also say that's in the absence of community harm or union harmonisation in this area. That's confirmed in Dan O'Shemi, which involved access. So Fleiderer was accessing the German Competition Authority's documents. Dan O'Shemi was documents held by the court. They again confirm this principle that there can be no absolute requirement, no absolute bar to disclosure in these cases. ENBW is a similar enough case relating to the transparency regulations and disclosure of material held by the European Commission. So this was a new, I suppose, problem that had emerged, which stems in part from the use of the principle of national procedural autonomy and the fact that we have the EU law rights being enforced by member states, potentially to differing outcomes. And you do see differing outcomes. So Fleiderer, the court denied disclosure, but in the National Grid case in the UK, partial disclosure was allowed. There's also a question about the principle of effective judicial protection raised by OTIS, a slightly different idea. This relates to Article 16.1 of Regulation 1 of 2003, which says that the binding effect of the infringement decisions of the European Commission have binding effects before the national courts, which means that if the Commission finds a cartel, you have conclusive evidence of a cartel for the purposes of follow-on litigation. All you have to do is prove causation and harm that you have suffered. Makes things far easier. The question here was whether the principle of effective judicial protection would start to cause problems here. In OTIS, the Court of Justice gives actually quite a lot of it's quite a generous treatment of the Commission and the Commission procedures, and says it's fine because we have the residual possibility of judicial review, but it still raises some problematic issues. Let's look at the role of the Commission in the evolution of private enforcement and how the Commission has, I suppose, sought to develop the principles from Courage and Manfredi and encourage them at a national level, and how it's also dealing with some of the problematic issues that have been raised in Fleiderer, now Dan O'Shemi. So in 2006, on the back of the Courage decision, the Commission launches a consultation with a green paper on damages actions in the national court, at the national level by national courts. In the green paper, it identified problems of total underdevelopment of damages actions before national courts and an astonishing diversity of available approaches in member states, which start to create problems in terms of cherry picking or unequal protection of EU law rights. I should say that actually this conclusion is disputed by practitioners in particular, who point to the fact that you have a lot of settlements that the Commission doesn't see. So actually there's probably a lot more competition litigation out there than the Commission thinks. The Commission is just looking at final decisions. But the Commission still insists that the principle, these principles need to be developed. In the Green Paper, the Commission proposed a whole range of potential options and sought views. So things on access to evidence, the question of whether the National Competition Authority decision should have the same effect as Article 16.1 of Regulation 1 of 2003, fault, liability, calculation of damages, passing on defence, the very controversial question of collective actions or class actions, which have been very prominent in the US and have been very successful in the US in encouraging competition litigation, but on the other hand, start to raise a lot of problems if they are opt out. So if you find that a class is defined so that it has 2 million people in it, and you don't know you're in the class and you don't know what happens with the class action, seen as a driver of unmeritorious litigation in the US. A whole series of issues were raised. The response from the Commission to the responses of the consultation comes in 2008, the White Paper on Damages Actions, where the Commission acknowledges that some of the things it had proposed were very, very unpopular in the EU. It emphasises we need a genuinely European approach, which means we abandon things like multiple damages, we abandon opt out collective actions. They also abandoned their proposals for overall harmonization and started to narrow down to look at what they saw as, I suppose, potentially very problematic aspects, and also probably things they thought that they could actually harmonize successfully. The idea of an overall harmonization was just really too ambitious. Interestingly, what the Commission says in the 2008 paper is they emphasize that they pick up on the ideas of Manfredi, that the right of damages is a sort of a universal right, which stems from infringement of Article 101 and 102. So it's any victim of an antitrust infringement has to be able to exercise the right to compensation. It covers all categories of victims, all types of breach, and all sectors of the economy. And they proposed a whole series of issues to be harmonized. This culminates in a draft directive in 2008, which they work on for quite a while, which is then leaked in Brussels shortly before it's about to be announced, proves to be hugely controversial and is immediately shelved and is never actually formally announced. Nothing happens with it. There were two particularly controversial issues with this directive. The first is the inclusion of a de facto opt-out collective action requirement, which really irritates some of the member states, which feel this is very, very violent with respect to their legal culture. The other is the use of Article 103 TFEU as a legal basis, which of course is going to exclude the Parliament, which really irritates the Parliament. And from what I understand, actually President Barroso stepped in and was instrumental in nixing the whole project because it was just going to cause too much difficulty in terms of the EU itself and interinstitutional relations. The Commission continues to work. In particular, it looks at collective action as a horizontal issue rather than an antitrust-specific issue. It holds consultations, and in 2013, as part of a package of measures on antitrust damages actions, it issues a recommendation on common principles for collective redress. So antitrust is specifically identified as an area where collective redress is of value, but the principles are horizontally and equally applicable through any area of EU law where collective claims may be relevant. It says member states should put in place measures that are going to facilitate collective redress, but it's a non-binding requirement, and member states, if they want to ignore it, are free essentially to ignore it. The second aspect of the package of measures on antitrust damages from June 2013 is this practical guide on quantifying harm. This has been identified as a specific issue that it has been particularly problematic for national courts, because you may have an antitrust infringement on the basis of a Commission decision, but it's actually very difficult to figure out what is the harm, what is the level of harm. And so we have this non-binding, non-exhaustive guidance from the Commission, which just sets out the techniques you may use, the things you may take into account, and tries to provide guidance for national courts on this issue. What's really interesting about the consultation is the fact that it's urging national courts to be less precise about this to a certain extent. It urges national courts to accept a degree of imprecision which reflects technical limitations and ambiguities inherent in the task. It also takes the principle of full compensation from Manfredi as the starting point. And so it emphasizes we need to try and realize this through the very imprecise tools we have available. I will come back to this in a few moments. We also have a draft directive on damages, covering most of the issues that were identified in the white paper as being problematic. The legal bases are now Article 103 and Article 114, and Article 114 is used because the principles extend to harmonisation of national rules and national procedures for enforcing the competition rules. Vice President Almunia, who has responsibility for competition affairs, gave a very interesting speech in November last year, where he basically barely even veiled his threats to the Parliament, where he said, "We have finally given you a role in this. Bear in mind, you now have responsibilities. Please don't be so obstructive that we can't realise this. It would not be responsible to the consumers of Europe." So the commission has given the parliament a role, but is trying to prevent the parliament, I suppose, from being too obstreperous in exercising its role. The aims of the directive are twofold, and this is set out in draft article one. It's about clarifying the relationship between public and private enforcement, which addresses the Donal Shemi Fidra problem, and it wants to strengthen procedures for damages actions at the national level to increase levels of private enforcement in member states. Contents of the draft directive. So it restates the principles of full compensation, effectiveness, and equivalence. It requires national courts, member states to empower national courts to order proportionate disclosure where there are plausible grounds for suspecting an antitrust breach, with specific exceptions to deal with the FLIDR issues, so corporate leniency statements and settlement submissions. And in this regard, they seem to have the Commission's own settlement procedure for cartels in mind, are totally excluded from disclosure, and material that has been prepared for the purposes of competition authority proceedings, either by the competition authority or by people under investigation or third parties, are excluded from disclosure while the proceedings are ongoing. The binding effect of NCA infringement decisions, so this will be equivalent to Article 16.1 of Regulation 1 of 2003 for national infringement decisions. When this draft directive went through council last month, this article was amended to limit the cross-border effects. So it's only the effect of the NCA decision is only binding within your own jurisdiction. In other jurisdictions, they have to be seen as evidence of breach, but not conclusive proof. I suppose limits to the national solidarity in terms of competition proceedings. Limitation periods must now be a minimum of 5 years, which are going to be stopped for investigations and which also don't begin to run until the competition problem is discovered. There will be joint and several liability for joint behaviour, where the competition infringement is committed by two or more parties together jointly. We don't quite know what joint behaviour means. There was supposed to be, or the Commission had intended, a level of protection for immunity recipients from the joint and several liability provisions. This has been removed following council debate on this issue. Joint and several liability was only going to be an issue if the immunity recipients would be liable for their own harm. They wouldn't be liable for all the harm of the cartel unless the plaintiffs couldn't get full compensation from others. This seems to have been deleted by the council. The passing on defence will now be available if a cartel overcharge has been passed on. So you can say, I don't owe you damages because you just charged your consumers extra. And indirect purchasers have been, as a result, given standing. This is in contrast to the approach in US federal antitrust, where passing on defence is not allowed and indirect purchasers do not have standing. The US reason is that it just simplifies things. I suppose it would be incompatible with the EU idea of full compensation. There's a rebuttable presumption of harm in cartel cases, and there's a proviso that national rules on quantifying harm must not be so stringent as to render the right of private action practically impossible or excessively difficult, and provision is made for consensual dispute resolution. Things that are not covered are collective actions, which are covered by the recommendation, but there will be no requirements in that regard. Fault causation, things like the treble damages that encourage litigation in the US, costs, conflict of laws. Member states can, of course, legislate individually on these issues. So the UK has a new competition regime proposed, which will allow for the opt-out collective actions under certain conditions, which have been problematic at the EU level. The question, I suppose, that I'm going to look at now is the disjuncture between rhetoric and reality that seems to arise within EU competition law. We have this starting point, the idea from Manfredi, that both 101 and 102 are matters of public policy. Both are deserving of a right of private enforcement. The Commission in the White Paper was emphatic that it is, in theory, available to all victims of all cartel breaches for all sorts of damage which has been suffered. Private enforcement should be available. The question, or I suppose the difficulty, is that if you look at the emerging structure of private enforcement in the EU, it's quite difficult to defend this idea. The first thing you notice is that the coverage of the 2013 package is heavily skewed towards cartel actions. So a number of the provisions only relate to issues that are going to come up in private litigation in relation to cartels, the presumption of harm, the protection of leniency material, and so forth. A lot of the other provisions deal with issues that are going to be of greatest assistance or potentially only relevant really in practice in cartel litigation. So protecting settlement submissions, things like the rules on joint and several liability, which require joint behavior to breach 101 or 102, passing on and indirect purchaser standing, which really in the great majority of cases arise in cartel cases, and even disclosure, which is universally available, it's going to be of greatest use in cartel cases, secret cartel cases, where information asymmetries between the defendant and the plaintiff are greatest. Really interestingly, I think, is the approach to quantification of harm, because our principle here is full compensation, reiterated by the draft directive, reiterated in the Commission's communication on this point, and coming from Manfredi. But full compensation is something that only, when you look at the advice given in the practical guide on quantification of harm, it only relates to overcharges and not to foreclosure. If you look at paragraph, this is from paragraph 203 and paragraph 192. Foreclosed competitors may decide to seek damages only in relation to the costs borne in order to enter the market, rather than the whole of the profits foregone. This approach can be more straightforward than claiming damages for loss of profits, as it only involves quantifying the sunk costs incurred by the claimants. The actual impact of this is really quite great. It might be a kind of a glib comparison to make, but if you think of this in terms of a case like Von Colson, this is Ms. Von Colson getting her train fare, which here the equivalent would be, I suppose, the cost you spend on advertising, rather than her actual loss, which was she lost the money and the rights she would have gotten through employment. Here, the people who are foreclosed from a market lose the right to participate in the market and make profits and so forth. Well, all they're going to get, and in paragraph 192, they elaborate a little on this, would be things like the wasted advertising costs. This is quite a serious departure from the principle of full compensation. And the Commission doesn't explain it, but the practical impact is that in foreclosure cases, which are far more likely to arise in 102 or non-cartel 101 cases, we don't actually have what the court says is the right to full compensation is going to be realised. Foreclosure is unlikely to arise in a cartel case unless it's something like a collective boycott. And then just, I suppose, as a point of interest, the white paper, the impact assessment, considers only the cost of cartels. It doesn't say that there aren't any other costs from other violations, but it is focusing only on cartels. The other important aspect is the emerging dichotomous public enforcement framework. Because we say that Article 16.1 of Regulation 1 of 2003 creates a binding effect for infringement decisions of the Commission. The directive wants to extend this to national competition authority decisions, but this is only going to be relevant if we have an infringement decision. And if you look at what's happening with enforcement at the Commission level specifically at the moment, only cartels are really going through the infringement decision procedures, plus some anomalous cases where it seems like the sort of defendants really irritate the Commission, something like Telekom Polska or Intel, where there seems to almost be a clash of personalities with the parties. Infringement decisions bring fines. They also bring this binding evidence of conclusive evidence of proof that you can use in follow-on proceedings. Non-cartel offences are most typically now settled under the commitment procedure, which leads to, I suppose, it ameliorates the market failure because we have behavioural or structural changes that will restore competition, that will deal with the identified competition problem, but we have no finding of breach, so we have no binding effect for the purposes of follow-on litigation, at the national level. And this is, I suppose, doubly problematic because non-cartel offences are acknowledged to be particularly difficult, not just to establish an infringement, but also in terms of establishing things like causation and loss. The Commission's impact assessment on the draft directive acknowledges this explicitly, that we have problems at all aspects here. The Commission doesn't, however, deal with this at all. It's very interesting that the draft directive says it's about the relationship between, it's about resolving the relationship between public and private enforcement, but only does so from the perspective of the potential negative impacts of private enforcement on public enforcement rather than vice versa. Whereas this issue here is the potential negative impacts of public enforcement or the choice of public enforcement instrument on the chances of realizing private enforcement. Finally, this is, I suppose, the more contentious aspect of what I'm saying, the substantive content of the EU rules outside the hardcore context. I think I am definitely running out of time, so I won't go through all of this. But there is a question as to whether the quite interventionist EU rules outside the cartel context, cartel rules or the prohibition on cartels is essentially the same in US and EU law, we get a divergence when we go into Article 102 and non-hardcore 101 offences, though. And what's been really interesting in US law has been the impact of what the institutional context. The Supreme Court has been quite explicit about the fact that it takes into account institutional concerns in shaping the really quite narrow now contours of non-cartel offences under US antitrust. Because these rules are very expansive rules, like some of the prohibitions under 102, are not particularly well suited to a private enforcement context. And even the Commission itself has acknowledged that, for example, the prohibition on excessive pricing, it very rarely brings excessive price cases because it has said explicitly it doesn't want to be a price regulator. Whereas I think you can't really give, you can't really expect a private plaintiff to have the same, I suppose, concerns in this regard. And even if these cases don't succeed as standalone actions because they're difficult to bring, you still have the potential, the chill on innovation that might arise. You also have the wasted cost of litigation, which is a form of rent seeking, which leads to waste in society overall. There is also the argument that potentially this may lead the European courts, or more likely the national courts as they try to interpret and apply the EU provisions, to pull back from the broader scope of some of the protections provided under antitrust law. Again, that's a very, very speculative argument, but it is a consideration. And I think if you look at the current debate surrounding Section 5 of the Federal Trade Commission Act, you actually see these concerns in reverse. Section 5, there's a current argument that Section 5, which allows the Federal Trade Commission to prohibit unfair methods of competition, there's an argument that it should be expanded to fill the gaps in existing antitrust protections, which have arisen because the court is so worried about private enforcement. And the argument here is that these provisions can only be enforced by the FTC, and so we can't have private plaintiffs. We have the expert enforcement, and this means that we have, I suppose, it's safer. It's more reasonable to think that we could have more expansive rules. Really interestingly, one of the sort of acknowledged potential impacts of this is that U.S. Antitrust would look more like U.S. antitrust outside the EU antitrust outside the cartel context, but only within the confines of public enforcement. And so I think I think it's an interesting comparison to make. Okay, does this really matter? On the one hand, is this just a matter of words? Is this just an academic looking at some documents and thinking, ooh, can I find something that I can talk about? I suppose we do accept a lot of gaps between practical reality and the rhetoric of the court in areas of EU law. The status of EU citizenship is supposed to be the primary status of every national of member states, and we're intended to move towards this moment, hasn't quite arrived yet, and we don't actually seem to be getting there very fast, and we can live with that disjuncture. There's also a very heavily commercial context here, so that maybe we shouldn't be too precious about these ideas when almost all private enforcement actions are going to be one company suing another company, and they'll probably have long-standing commercial relations anyway, and they might just settle and you get a 20% discount off next year's order as a result. Another thing to think about is the question of whether the availability of damages as a remedy is distinct from the question of appropriateness. Because maybe all the court is saying is that we have a whole series of different instruments that are available. In some instances, private enforcement will help with the effectiveness of competition supervision. In others, where we have a very, say, speculative theory of harm, or it's actually very difficult to establish injury, maybe it's not so useful, but at least you have it available in theory. You don't necessarily have to apply the private, or there doesn't have to be private enforcement in every instance. The flip side of this, and this is something I alluded to slightly earlier, is the question of what effectiveness means, basically, in this instance. If we just say that courage is establishing a right to claim damages, then maybe it's enough to say it's potentially available, and if you can satisfy the requirements of, if you can show an infringement, even if it's a standalone action, and you can show harm, even though it's really hard to do so, and you can show causation, then that's fine. And so we don't need anything more, even in the context of 102 and non-hardcore 101 offences, than we get in the package of measures and we get in the overall enforcement framework. The flip side is if we say that EU law is granting a right to damages, like equivalent to a Frankovic right, the question is, in that instance, does the principle of effectiveness require more of the member states and, in a sense, more of the Commission? And the argument for doing more is that the directive and the efforts of the Commission thus far have pointed towards, I suppose, a need to do more to realise the rights from Courage and the rights from Manfredi. I should say this is a point I would like criticisms on, because I'm not sure whether it actually makes sense. This, I suppose, would be the only reason why, or would be one of the reasons why you might argue that a one-sided focus on protecting certain aspects of the right to private enforcement might be problematic. Finally, in this context, it's interesting to note that the emphasis on cartel overcharges, or the vertical value chain, people, consumers who have suffered harm as a result of being overcharged by sellers, and an economist called Frank Kriegel-Meyer published an article just last week pointing to this particular critique in the quantifying harm guidelines. The question is whether this maybe answers the frequent criticism of EU competition law that it prioritises competitors over consumers, because here, in terms of private enforcement, the framework seems to be very much favouring the consumer and recovery by the consumer rather than recovery by competitors. 102 cases, many of a lot of these claims are going to be rivals who have been foreclosed, forced out of the market, whereas 101 cartel cases in particular is generally going to be overcharged competitors. And that is everything. So, thank you.